with iron fist because everybody wants to escape very, very much on time. Okay, so with this, I hand it over to Sjors as the first contributor.
Thank you, Joachim. Thank you, Joachim. Thank you, Bridget and Clint and Ron, for inviting me. It's always very good to be at this meeting. I think the special thing about this meeting is all these discussions and these panels, and especially this time what I've learned is that everybody has an opinion, and they're not necessarily all the same. So I thought I'd give you mine, but it's only my opinion, okay? And it's introduction and an overview of new approaches that that Clint, Bridget, and Ron asked me to speak about. Okay, basically, how do we go from these fields of very noisy particles to a high resolution map? And this was the description I got. So, let's see. Comprehensive overview of the major advances that have taken place in the last few years and that have enabled maps to achieve atomic resolution, and then an impressive list of things that I had to cover in 45 minutes, okay? Now, in the last few years, few could be a subjective term, and that have enabled maps to achieve atomic resolution. So first of all, I'd like to mention that what I'll discuss will be mostly later, more recent work, but and people have been speaking about revolution, but I think in image processing much has been rather evolutionary progress as well. So perhaps everything started with David Rozier's and Aaron Kluck's paper in 68, and then I think for single particle processing, lots of hard work on ribosomes especially, and then later on other large complexes by Joachim Marin, Michael Powell, and many others, okay? Sorry if I left you out. So that's what this talk is not about. But many things in the talk have kind of evolved from all this this work. Okay, so let's start. This is an NRAM course, and I thought I'd do some teaching. And Bridget was very strict in instructing us. This is not a beauty competition. So I apologize, Bridget. I will focus on two of my favorite particles to do this. And the first one is Jan. And we'll use him as an example protein. So Jan is some three-dimensional entity, and we'd like to determine its three-dimensional structure. Okay. What we do is we have an electron microscope, and very fancy one. Jan somehow has to go in. And we discussed all that on Monday. Basically, we put Jan in a shallow swimming pool. He'll be tumbling around. Well, there's actually many copies of Jan here. And some will be swimming upside down and up front and in all kinds of different orientations. And then we do something very nasty. We freeze him very quickly in liquid ethane. And then we put him in the microscope. Okay. Now, inside that microscope, things get even nastier. So we'll start shooting this very damaging electron beam on Jan. Okay. And under some reasonable approximations, what this gives as a two-dimensional image of three-dimensional copies of Jan in the swimming pool is that you get the so-called, mathematically it's called an X-ray integral, and that's basically because it does the same as you do an X-ray picture in the hospital. So X-rays in the hospital will go through Jan and give it an X-ray projection, and something very similar happens to our molecules. So if Jan is a molecule, the electron beam will go through it, and by some reason, under reasonable assumptions, you get an X-ray integral, or just a projection of the scattering potential inside Jan, which kind of is a good indicator of its three-dimensional structure. Now, because these pictures are rather scary, I thought I'd replace two-dimensional projections by black and white pictures. Okay, so this is a three-dimensional Jan, and this is its two-dimensional projection. Good. That's problem number one. We record two-dimensional images, whereas we're really interested in the three-dimensional structure of Jan. So one of these will not get us too far about knowing about the three-dimensional one. Okay. So there's other inconvenience in the microscope. So due to the way contrast is formed, so we need to defocus, and then there's all kind of imperfections, and some of this was discussed yesterday as well. And this leads to artifacts in the images. So rather than having a perfect projection of Jan, we'll get something more that looks like this. Contrast disappears, some things that were white become black and the other way around, etc. So that's inconvenient. Another inconvenience is that Jan is extremely sensitive to this radiation, because he will get burned away quite quickly. So we have to take these pictures under very low light, if you want, under very low dose, and that gives rise to a huge amount of noise. So Jan gets the beautiful projection image that we in principle had somewhere, first gets distorted by all kind of artifacts, and then a lot of noise gets added to it. Good. Now, I've removed the noise in the artifacts because otherwise the pictures get a bit ugly again. But because Jan was swimming upside down and in many different orientations in that shallow swimming pool, we take multiple pictures of Jan, and they're all different orientations, okay? And we don't really know in what orientation Jan is in each of the pictures. That's something we need to find out. And then we have to combine all these two-dimensional projections into a three-dimensional reconstruction so that we get a three-dimensional map of Jan. Good. How does that work? So I thought I'd first introduce projection matching to those, especially to those of the students who are new to the field. I thought there's some... The pictures are rather crude, but there's some fundamental aspects that I would like you to learn. So we start with some initial guess, three-dimensional guess of how Jan will look like. And now there's all kind of methods that we can use to obtain such an initial model, and I won't discuss many of them today, okay? So you can tilt your sample in the microscope, you can calculate only from untilted data, but there are ways, trust me, that you can get some initial crude estimate of how Jan looks in 3D. For example, I might have heard he looks a bit like a puppet, okay? So then I can make in the computer some initial guess of how a puppet would look like, and then in the computer calculate these projections of this puppet in many different orientations, actually in all different 3D orientations of Jan. Okay, so I can make top views, I can make side views, front views, etc. These we call reference projections. Then, for every experimental particle of Jan, again, I've taken away the artifacts and the large amount of noise, but they're there for real data, okay, I'm going to compare in the computer how the experimental particle of Jan compares with each of these projections. And not only that, I'm also going to rotate them around and translate them around if we don't know the in-plane rotation, and perhaps the pictures we've taken are slightly out of center as well. Okay, so I can come up with some kind of similarity measure, just a number that I compute when comparing two images with each other, and see where that fits best. So people have used the cross-correlation coefficient to do that. And for example, there is this particular particle will have the best correlation coefficient for this view. Okay, so then that particle moves there. And then we do the next one. And that we do for all the 10,000 or 100,000, some people like to do millions of particles. Okay, so that all of these particles get assigned a relative orientation with respect to the 3D reference that was this initial puppet. Good. Once we've done that for all particles, we now have the problem of three-dimensional reconstruction. How do I go about, if I have all these two-dimensional projection images from different directions, how can I calculate a three-dimensional map back from that? And I think John did a beautiful job the other day, yesterday was it, on explaining Fourier transforms, okay? And I'm going to briefly mention the projection slice theorem because I think it's very insightful in how you could computationally do this 3D reconstruction. So if you have any three-dimensional map, so it's a three-dimensional image. John spoke about one-dimensional and two-dimensional images, but it's general. You can go to any dimension. You can calculate its Fourier transform. It will look a bit funny because it's space we're not used to looking at, okay? But it's basically what John described. You can do Fourier transform or inverse. It's just a mathematical expression, a mathematical operation to express the information in a different manner. Now, if we take a projection image using these X-ray integrals, for example, all along these red dotted lines here, then this is a two-dimensional projection image of whatever was here in three dimensions, okay? Ignore the colors. Now, we could, just following John again, we could just take the two-dimensional Fourier transform of the projection image. Now, the projection slice theorem says that this two-dimensional Fourier transform is a central slice through this three-dimensional transform. So central slice meaning it's you can take this, which is a two-dimensional plane, and you can put that plane in the 3D transform. And it goes through the middle. So at the middle here is this origin in the Fourier transform that John mentioned. And the direction of this slice is perpendicular to, so the plane is orthogonal to these to the projection direction of that we took. Okay? So that's useful because if I had all these individual raw particles assigned in different orientations, I can calculate their two-dimensional Fourier transforms. And I can put now all these, because they're all in different orientations, I can put all these slices back, these old two-dimensional planes back in the three-dimensional transform. And if I put enough of them, it will actually cover more or less the entire transform, hopefully. That's shown here. And then all that remains is to do an inverse transform. It's slightly more complicated than that, but you do this inverse transform, and then you get what we call a three-dimensional reconstruction. Okay? Now, this looks somewhat funny, and that's another important concept here, because I've made a reconstruction of images that are only projection images of Jan. Okay? There is no images of this puppet that I had in the data that I used to do this Fourier transforms and then the inverse transform from the 3D, okay? So no puppet data at all goes in, yet what comes out of the process is something that looks like the true Jan reconstruction, but it's actually, it also still looks like the initial puppet. And the reason for that is there's so much noise on all these individual particles that the comparison of these noisy particles with the projection of our puppets has kind of, we call this model bias. It has introduced small errors in the angles that, or the orientations that we assign, and the errors are in such a way that the actual initial puppet gets kind of reproduced in the reconstruction. So it's imperfect angles because we had an imperfect reference, and it has a nasty effect that the reconstruction kind of looks like that imperfect reference. However, it's all made of particles of Jan, so there is good hope that it not only reflects this initial puppet, it also reflects somewhat the reconstruction of true Jan particle. So that's why it's kind of a mixture. Now, that's good news, because that means we're going in the right direction. And we can now repeat the process, we can iterate it, and we can again make projections in the computer of this kind of mixed reconstruction, use it, go through the same procedure, compare every particle with these projections, so that hopefully, because this looks more like Jan than what we started with, the errors in these angles will become smaller, and so that if we repeat it, everybody moves around a little bit, and the reconstruction will now have less of the puppet and more of Jan. So we can iterate this all the way through until hopefully we converge to a point where we have a clean reconstruction of Jan and all the angles are correct. So that's what we call projection matching or refinement. Good. Next topic, image restoration techniques. So I told you that defocusing and the microscope imperfections give these artifacts, okay? And we've discussed the CTF in the days before today. So the effect on the image is going from a perfect image to something where contrast is inverse. Some things that are white in the original image become black. Overall contrast goes down, etc. Now, what do we do with that? And again, that's some of the basics go go back quite far away. This is a paper from 71. But we've seen some of these curves earlier this week, where we have the contrast transfer function, which describes as a function of spatial frequency, so in Fourier space, whether contrast gets inverted because it's negative or it stays the same because it's positive. At some of the frequencies, contrast is zero, so all the information is actually lost. So then the question comes, how do we have to restore or estimate the image of the true Jan reconstruction if all these images are kind of messed up in such a nasty way? So if you think of this, you can... John explained every image can be expressed the same information in the Fourier space. And so it may not come as a surprise that you can do this description of this CTF effect either in real space, in the one we live, or in Fourier space. Okay, in real space, these effects of the CTF become a convolution. Okay, and it's a convolution with a point spread function. So every point in our perfect image kind of gets spread out over multiple pixels in the image, and they kind of all go into each other using this convolution operation. So we have a certain volume, and we take a projection of it. Then that clean, perfect projection somehow gets convolved with a point spread function. Now, in real space, then this is a projection operator. It actually does these X-ray integrals. You calculate sums along lines of projections, and then convolution becomes a bit of a nasty operation to do in real space. So the good thing about the Fourier space is, as we just discussed, the projection just becomes taking a slice out of a 3D transform. That's easier than doing line integrals. And also the effect of the CTF in the Fourier domain, and that's a theorem that John didn't discuss. It's Fourier convolution theorem, but a convolution in real space becomes a multiplication in Fourier space. And multiplications are much easier to deal with in the computer than these convolutions. So Fourier space is a very useful space for us to quickly make projections and to describe the effects of the CTF. Okay. Now, one way people have gone about this, and some people still do, and it's not such a bad idea, is phase flipping. So I've told you that part of these CTFs are negative and others are positive. So negative means that whatever is black at that frequency in the image will become white and vice versa. Now, that if you know which frequencies that happen, you can kind of just take the absolute value of this, just flip them around, okay? So you just you take the opposite sign of the CTF. This way, it's something relatively easy. You can do it on your micrograph, and then you can extract your particles. At least everything is positive, so whatever is white stays white. There's some information still where some frequencies where the information is completely lacking, but you can kind of ignore that and just do a refinement like I described before with these kind of images. Okay, you won't make these gross errors of go from white to black, but there are still these points with missing information which you don't treat, which you kind of ignore, but that works relatively okay. Okay, so that's not very nice. Reconstructions at reasonable resolutions have been obtained using this technique, and an advantage is definitely that's very easy to do. And somebody came to me on Monday and said, I have a problem with classification, and I get classification according to defocus in the microscope. And then we went into detail, and all he did was phase flipping. So I think, especially for classification, but also for true high-resolution refinement, just phase flipping might not get most of your data. Okay, but it works reasonably well. I think a better way to treat CTFs, and a lot of work on this has been done as well, Powell has been an important contributor, is the Wiener filter. And the Wiener filter states that we can calculate, this is all in the Fourier domain, where the CTF can be modeled by multiplications. It states that we can do this reconstruction of V by putting, this is the operator that puts an image, a 2D transform back into the 3D space, okay? And we can put images back into the 3D space, some overall images, so that's more or less what I mentioned in the beginning. But there's something special in the case of CTF. We multiply every image by the CTF, and we divide, that gives a sum of images, 2D slices, put all in the 3D Fourier transform, and we divide that by another 3D array where we've kind of kept the sum of the CTF squared in those same kind of slices, okay? And then there is some complications to that, that there you divide the CTF by the power of the noise in the experimental image, and then also here in the division of CTF squared. But that, and then you add to the sum of all these images, you add something which is the inverse of the power of the signal. Now, I won't have time to go into the detail of this theory, but the effect of the sigma and the tau here is that this Wiener filter not only corrects for the CTF, okay, it also actually acts as a low-pass filter. So that's not surprising, because this is also called optimal linear filter. It gives you the best possible reconstruction, the least noisy one, giving assumptions in some assumptions of the data. And so it should get rid of high-resolution noise, and that's basically how much faster does the signal drop with frequency than the noise drops with frequency, but also how many particles am I actually averaging over is important, okay? Now, what people have done in the past, which is a bit of a problem, I think, is to use this signal-to-noise ratio as a constant. Now, and we know that's not true, because it drops quite quickly with frequency. And if you do that, then you get something which is called the Wiener filter constant, and then the low-pass filter effect of the Wiener filter is lost. Okay, so that's something one needs to be careful with, I think. Another thing, some people say, oh, I always pre-Wiener filter my images. I think that's mathematically not possible. Okay, that in some way you're making approximations there that you can't really make, and that will be incorrect, because the true Wiener filter only you can only do when you average over all the things and you actually know over how many different instances you're going to average. Yes? Yeah, so sigma is the power of the noise in the experimental images. So you could do that for each image or average over multiple images. It's the power in the images. And if you have some images that are better than others, then that's hence the subscript I. Tau is the signal, which is supposedly the same in all the images. Okay, let me move on. So how to deal with heterogeneous populations? And then I thought I'd pull out Jan again. So this is a structural heterogeneous data set of Jan, because in approximately half of the particles, he's in complex with his favorite cofactor. Okay? Now, we have a problem, because we need to assign all these relative orientations. So there's top views, side views, etc. Ignore that Jan is moving around. He was hard to keep still. But we basically have to distinguish top and side views from each other, and also distinguish top views with and without, and side views with and without the cofactor. Okay, the way that this has been done a lot is multi-reference refinement. So we go through the same procedure, the projection matching procedure, but we use two different references. Now, if I somehow know that Jan is a puppet and he might have something in his left hand, then I can make a model without something and a model with something. For each of the experimental particles, I will compare it with projections of both models, and I will assign both the orientation and the class that it's most similar to. Okay, that I can iterate through, and then hopefully at some point all the projections without the cofactor will go here, and all the ones with the cofactor will go there, and I can do two reconstructions of both conformations. I'll come back to this. So what are the hot topics in processing, and what are the major approaches and available software to these hot topics? Okay, so this is where we enter more in opinion land. I think hot topics are 3D classification, unsupervised, and also everybody's excited to see sidechains. So high resolution refinement is a hot topic, I think. And I think there's two important contributions there. So let's do unsupervised classification first. So this, I told you, if you have the idea that Jan could have something in his left hand, then you can use that as initial reference, then that works quite well. So that kind of approach has been termed supervised classification, because you have to tell the classification approach, the answer. Okay? Now, that's not the way, that's not very useful in many cases. It has been useful, especially for ribosomes, where sometimes you know they're rigid, and so you can steer things your way. But in general, for many other complexes, and also for many ribosomes, you would rather like to do this unsupervised. So you don't really know what's kind of different conformations happen in your data set, yet you would still like to figure out how what different conformations are present. Good. So that brings me to maximum likelihood approaches. In maximum likelihood approaches, and I'll come back to this in a slide, we marginalize over orientations and classes. That means we calculate probability-weighted assignments. I'll come back to that. Stay with me. And this was first described by Fred Sickworth in a beautiful paper in JSB in 1998. And I think if you're a student in this room and you haven't read it yet, you should go and read it. So this was described for the most simple case, I think, two-day alignment against a single reference. And it has a certain real space data model, which I will not discuss now. And then the implementation software was in MATLAB scripts. Okay. Now that was in 1998. Then I think it went quiet for a while. And then from around 2005 to 2010, with the XMAP team, we implemented extensions of Fred's approach to two-dimensional classification and 3D classification. And I will explain it in a minute. Okay. And then recently, only last year, I think, also Nico hooked up onto this development, and there's now a three-dimensional maximum likelihood-based classification. So he makes some shortcuts, but it's inspired by the maximum likelihood classification, but he makes some shortcuts to make it go much faster. One important one, he does not marginalize over orientations. But so also FreeAlign can now do maximum likelihood-like classifications. Okay, so what does that mean, this probability-weighted assignment and this marginalization? So I've told you about projection matching and how we use the cross-correlation coefficient to assign individual particles to projections of the reference. Okay? So internally, I calculate the cross-correlation coefficient between this experimental particle and this view. It's perhaps rather obvious that this view is better, so the cross-correlation coefficient is higher, and then perhaps this cross-correlation is the highest. Okay? And then I'll assign Jan, this particle of Jan, to this orientation. Now, that's fine, but I told you there is a lot of noise in the real experimental particles. And because of all that noise, it might be that the difference of 0.32 here and 0.31 is actually just due to noise, and it could actually be that the correct orientation was this one. So just because of noise and stochasticity in this assignment, you might make the wrong decision based on very small differences in cross-correlation values. Or if you would plot all the orientations against cross-correlation, make a very long plot, it would be a very noisy one, and we're just going to get the best one. Okay, but that might be just because of stochasticity. Good. So... And it's the same type of stochasticity, actually, that we discussed on Monday about classes being only 60% overlap and so on. I think some of that is rather expected from the noisy character of our images, that these assignments are all stochastic because of noise in the images. In the maximum likelihood approach, we use a statistical model of the noise to calculate a probability for all orientations. So we calculate some probability value for this view, which wasn't very likely, and for this view, and for this view. The sum over all the probabilities will be 1, okay? And the probability metric, the way you calculate this, is actually not very different from the cross-correlation coefficient. So they are intrinsically related. Actually, if you do these kind of calculations, if there is no noise in the data, then you're doing exactly the same thing. Okay, so it sounds very different in probabilities and so on, but the actual deep down, it's not so different. The main difference is in the type of behavior that you get out of the algorithm, because now rather than saying this is the most likely orientation, this one had a lower cross-correlation coefficient, but it was rather similar correlation coefficient, much better than the one down here. So what you now do in maximum likelihood is you assign this particle to all different orientations, but you weigh every assignment with the probability. So these ones, and that's a bit like the thickness of the line here. So Jan goes into the reconstruction in all different orientations, but you do a weighted assignment. So 0.4 of the weights will be here, 0.35 will be here, there's almost nothing here, and the rest, which makes it sum to one, goes somewhere else as well. And kind of if you want to think about this in an intuitive way, you, rather than making a decision that can be wrong based on very noisy signals, you'd rather hold back and be a bit more conservative and not make a discrete decision, make like a fuzzy decision if you want, okay? Good. So for 3D classification, we call this ML3D classification, you do something similar, you assign all orientations for Jan, not for one reference, but for both references. So Jan, every particle of Jan goes into both reconstructions in all possible orientations. And it depends on how noisy the data are, how sharp these probability distributions are. And then we showed together with Joachim, who provided a data set, which was 90,000 particles. This was in the good old days, this was on film. And it was about 10 angstrom. And they saw fragmented density for this elongation factor, and then the small subunit was blurred. Now, I told you I'd rather not impose on my classification problem that I kind of have to know what's going on in the data. The way we did that with the likelihood classification was we take this consensus reconstruction, we low-pass filter it rather harshly, and then we take four random subsets from the 90,000 particles, do an iteration of refinement separately, then we get four different models. They're randomly different because they're random subsets, but I don't think there's any biology to be learned from them yet, okay? It goes about being numerically different. Because what we then do, we now do a four-reference refinement. So in every iteration of this refinement, we present every particle to all four references. Every particle goes into all four references in all orientations, but according to these weights. If you do that for 25 iterations, then we saw that you can separate out different classes, okay? So this was the first time we would do unsupervised three-dimensional classification. Okay. Now, in 2012, so this was 2 years after I moved to the LMB, we published an extension to this, which was the regularized likelihood approach. This time, the data model was completely in Fourier space for the reason that I explained to you before. You can take very fast projections, and you can correct for the CTF conveniently. There's another more complicated reason why that's a good idea. You can model more complicated forms of noise, so probably the statistical noise model will be closer to what we observe as well. Okay. We do, again, these marginalizations over orientations and classes. And then we've added a regularization term to the likelihood function, which I won't go into much detail today, but basically you penalize high-frequency components in your reconstruction, so you don't want them to become very noisy. And actually, if you do it all in this it's a Bayesian-like framework, then you can derive the 3D Wiener filter in a rather elegant way, opinion again. These Bayesian approaches are very good at estimating learning parameters from the data themselves. So these parameters about signal-to-noise ratio are just learned from the data as you iterate through, together as you learn the 3D reconstruction. And that makes it that it's very relatively easy to use, rely on. It's not just because there's a big red publish button on it, but it's because the Bayesian framework makes a lot of decisions that perhaps you would have to otherwise provide to other programs makes them automatically for you. And that, in the end, leads to objectivity, which is a good thing for the field, I think. So that I implemented in RelyOn. Okay. Now, then we showed that using this, you can actually classify things even better. So this was a standard subset that Joachim made public to the people. There was 10,000 ribosomes. People thought it was 5,000 in this state and 5,000 in the other state. There was actually 600 particles, which were only 50S. And if you don't do this regularization where you prevent high frequencies from sneaking into your reconstruction, you're never going to find these small classes, Tom.
Yes.
Perhaps we do that one in the panel. Is that okay? Because it's a rather general question. Yeah. Please come back later. Okay. And this is just a recent application where we did this for a data set of 130,000 particles. We were able to actually finding a subset of the structure we were interested in, that it was only 5,000 of the particles. So it's only about 4% of the data. Now, that's not the only 3D classification tools that are out there. There is also these multi-reference projection matching refinements. You don't necessarily have to do them with maximum likelihood. They can also work without it, okay? And I think that has been implemented in Eman, in iMagic, in Spider. These are very general. You can implement whatever you want, okay? But many people use these as well. And then Powell has introduced something very different, where you take random subsets of particles and do many reconstructions. It's called bootstrapping, and that you can calculate 3D variants in your data. So you can calculate hotspots in your reconstruction where lots of heterogeneity is happening in your data, and you could use that then to do focus classification, make masks around those areas and classify data there, or you could even do multivariate statistical analysis of bootstrap maps. So also these methods are very powerful. I don't have too much data on them because we don't have much experience with them, but I know they're implemented in Spark, and people are also very happy with those. Okay. Second hot topic, high-resolution refinement, prevention of overfitting. So I've told you that because of errors in the angles, you can get certain bias in your reconstruction. Now, the field has made a bit of a deviation from the straight path at some point, where we were aligning a single reference against our data. The problem with that is that, and that's basically the algorithm I've just described to you using Jan. So the problem is, if a bit of noise starts creeping into your reference structure, so if this structure somehow becomes noisy in some way, then projections of that noise will be used to align your particles against. And then, just like the orange puppet came back, the noise can come back, okay? And that's called model bias. And Nico has done some very nice papers on model bias. And especially if you iterate this, then it becomes ever, ever worse. And noise tends to be rather high resolution. And then what we would do after every iteration, split the data in two and calculate the Fourier correlation. And it would be the same high resolution noise in the two half reconstructions. Then you get the FSC curves, which goes all the way out, and you overestimate your resolution. You don't apply low-pass filters as you should do, and then you overestimate your resolution, and you get very, very noisy maps. So that's overfitting, iterative overfitting, if you like, Nico. And I think there's two main ways to at least prevent that this iteratively gets worse. Within one iteration, I think there's always some extent, and every algorithm to some extent within one iteration will suffer from this, but you can at least not make it explode by iterating through your data. And one approach is to limit the resolution of your refinement. If you only limit the resolution that you use for alignment to, say, 8 angstroms, then the noise that gets reproduced because of this bias will be limited to 8 angstroms, and only beyond 8 angstroms, only real signal can actually come up. Okay? So that's implemented in FreeAlign, but you could do this in any package, because you could do, whether you use Eman or Spider or whatever, you could always start with a strict low-pass filter of your data at a given resolution, do your entire refinement, and then do the final reconstruction with unfiltered data. Okay, so this you could do in any package. This one you could basically do in most packages as well. It may require a bit more scripting. It's to independently refine two halves of the data. Because if you do that and calculate Fourier correlations between that, then this half will be slightly noisy. That's this one iteration of overfitting or model noise bias. And this one will be slightly noisy, but the difference, there will be different instances of noise, so they will never correlate. And iteration will only go forward if for things that are the same in the two halves. And then there's the assumption that only the signal in the two halves is the same. And that was first termed by Steve Lütke as gold standard way of doing things, okay? Now, I've heard some people say, oh, you should call this gold standard refinement, and some people, as included, call this gold standard Fourier-Shell correlation. I don't think it's my time worth discussing about it, but you can call it what you want. So this is now fully implemented in EMAN, and it's also in AutoRefine in Reliant, but as said, you could do this in any package. Okay. The reason why it works is that if you do a reconstruction from two halves of the data, that reconstruction is only slightly worse than the reconstruction from the entire data, and especially at the lower frequency, it's not much worse at all. And then you can actually measure this. We did this for simulated data, that orientations from reconstructions that you made from half of the data are basically indistinguishable. The amount of errors you make because of noise in the data is not bigger than if you do a whole reconstruction. And the reason is that alignments are driven by lower frequencies. And the lower frequencies are more or less as good in half reconstructions as in whole reconstructions. And then, of course, then the same holds for this limited resolution refinement. Is alignment only driven by lower frequencies? Then why would you use the higher frequencies if you have this risk of model bias? Okay. And then resolution criteria have been discussed to death as well in this field. But I think this gold standard FSC criteria of 1 over 7 or 0.143 has come out as a reliable indicator of resolution. At least in Reliant, if we have a resolution reported by this measurement at 4.7 or 4.8, we just about start to see beta strands separated. So I think that's a good one. And the main advantage of doing this is that your maps are very clean. Okay? There might be a disadvantage that the reported resolution is slightly lower than you would get from overfitted approaches. So there was a bit of psychology involved, but I think we've gone past that, and the result is now very clean maps with which everybody is very happy. Okay, last hot topic, movie processing, and I can go a bit faster here because most of it was already dealt with. So Jan has recently become a heterodimer with Matt, and this is now a new picture, and it's not a typical picture in the microscope because we know the electron beam starts hitting Jan and Matt if they're frozen in the swimming pool, then a lot of movement starts to happen. Okay? Now, before when we used photographic film, it's the same with my personal photo camera. If I have a photographic film and it would be playing like this, I develop the picture, or even a CCD camera, the picture would pretty much come out like this. So there's lots of blurring that lowers the information contents of the image. So in light photography, the same revolution has taken place, perhaps as in electron detection devices, because there also CMOS cameras came along, and you can put them in burst mode. This was actually taken on a CMOS camera. So rather than this, you can now do this and really see what's going on. Okay, so. And I think the first one to really address this was Nico, when he was actually here together with Bridget and Clint. And they were working on this prototype of the DE camera. And they found for rotavirus, you can actually follow the movements of these particles as they're being eliminated throughout the movies that you collect. And these beautiful pictures where you can then actually correct for that movement and go from very, very fuzzy viruses to much sharper ones. So that was, I think, a very important contribution. So then, and this has been discussed a lot yesterday, then there's basically two main approaches to doing this movie correction. The first one is per micrograph, or per large parts of micrographs, if you like. And I think Schumming's program, Motion Core, John described it yesterday, is really leading there. And a very useful tool. So because it was discussed, I'll go over it quite quickly. Then, as John also discussed, you can do this also, try and do this per particle. And programs where this has been implemented is Reliant. I don't know, FreeAlign, at least those rotaviruses were done in FreeAlign. And then John described his program, which is not called after the LMB. And also, in one of these parallel sessions yesterday, Ben spoke about implementations being done by direct electron as well. So there is, I think, and this list is growing every day. So many people develop programs for this. Okay? So the way it works, if this is a micrograph, it would be the average of the movie. Then really, rather than one average ribosome particle, you have And this is from a falcon, and in 1 second exposure, we get 16 of these images. Now, the ribosomes get very, very noisy because the dose in each of the frames is relatively low. And then Xiao Chen then divided the 16 frames into averages of 16 frames, or you can do two averages of 8 frames. You can make three averages of 6 frames or 4 or 4 frames, etc. And you can align these independently with respect to the 3D reconstruction and thereby describe the motion of every particle as it is being eliminated. And then you can plot these motions back on the micrograph, and what we basically found, some micrographs don't move at all. These were these perfect pictures that Yifan also mentioned. And some move a lot. These are actually exaggerated 25-fold. But here you can see the ribosomes are much more fuzzy. And then the funny thing, the unexpected thing we found, is that sometimes particles move in one direction, and here on this, on the same micrograph, particles here move in the other direction. So it's not just a drift of the stage or beam-induced drift of the entire field in one direction. There's all kind of patterns, and we have basically no clue what's going on. Okay. So this approach, which we published in 2013, worked well for large particles, so for ribosomes and viruses. For smaller particles, there is a problem because the dose in these individual frames becomes too low, because small particles already have lower signal-to-noise ratios. At some point, you can't align them anymore. There's so much noise, you just can't see your particles, you can't align them. So if we did the approach to a variety of samples with different molecular weights, the ribosome worked really well. You went from 3.9 angstrom resolution to almost 3.2 angstrom. But anything smaller, well, okay, complex 1 at 1 megadalton, it got slightly better, but perhaps not worth your money of doing all the movie processing. For anything smaller than a megadalton, things actually became worse. So beta-gal, half a megadalton, from 4.3 to 4.4. Gamma secretase, going through the notion of all the movie data collection, lots of disk space, etc., and then all with the effect that you decrease your resolution from 4.9 to 5.4 because you can't follow the particles in the movie. Okay, so that's when we published this new approach, and this is the 2014 approach. Is called particle polishing in Relion. And the first part is very similar to what John described for his program. So we somehow have very noisy movie tracks because our particles are small and they're hard to follow. So we first run the old approach, get these very noisy tracks, and then we try to smoothen them out. And John presented this very elegant L2 norm regularization to smooth things. We do a much more crude approach, I would say, is just fitting straight lines through the movement. Okay? So for those of you who were unhappy with John's approach, you can be three times as unhappy with this one. And then, because we've seen that particles in the neighborhood of the micrograph move in similar directions, we do the same thing as John described. We apply weighted least squares fits with neighboring particles. So there's many particles in similar areas of the grids that contribute to the same fits. And then for these small particles, we ignore rotations. Beam-induced rotations, you can't follow them for particles smaller than a big ribosome. So if you have an ADS ribosome, Relion can just about discern in during the movie rotation. And rotations are 1 or 2 degrees, which I think agrees well with observations by Tim on rotavirus. Anything smaller, just the accuracy that we have in aligning particles, is not good enough to follow beam-induced rotation. You can't. Xiao Chen mentioned 2.7 degrees or so yesterday for gamma secretase. If it rotates only, that's for the entire average of the movie. So if it rotates within that movie 2 degrees, you're no way going to find it. So we ignore them for small particles. So these are some fit tracks. Then the second part of this movie processing is, and this was discussed also by Hua, and I think also by somewhat by John yesterday, is that the different spatial frequencies get affected differently at different rates by the radiation damage. And this is a picture from Holger's paper from 96 on catalase crystals. And the way we go about this, we do these reconstructions from halves of the data for each individual movie frame. So we do half one, only frame one, half two, only frame two, calculate the Fourier-Shell correlation between it, and kind of deduce a B factor of that describes the fall-off in signal between those or within those reconstructions. And the kind of plots you get here, the get out of it are shown here for the three for the four data sets that we tried this on. And for those of you who do particle polishing, these are very important plots to look at, and they're stored in a file called bfactors.star, okay? And it's this bfactor, there's movie frame number on the x-axis and bfactor on the y-axis. I think the clearest example here is the mitochondrial ribosome. It's the highest resolution structure, there's less noise on these things. What you see, the initial first few frames are relatively large negative bfactor, which means that there's very little high-frequency components in them. And this was discussed yesterday because of initial fast movement, or whether it's movement, physical movement, or charging, we don't really know. But somehow, our first few frames are very bad. Then there is a regime where there's good high-resolution information, and then the bfactors start to become worse again. And that's where radiation damage starts setting in, and you shoot away your high-resolution information. Now, the actual y-axis here, because what we're going to do is make shiny particles where we realign every movie frame, and then we weigh, using these bfactor weights, we do relative contributions of each frame to a new average. It's a rated average. Because of that, the actual absolute scale of the bfactors doesn't matter. Some people have said, oh, what does it mean if it's a positive bfactor? You can add or subtract whatever number from these values, and it will still be the same. What's important? What's the difference between this initial one and the high one, and how much does it go down? And you should see for your data that things have this kind of behavior. If they don't, if they're very noisy, then you're not going to do anything useful. And especially for lower frequency, lower resolution reconstructions, this can be a tricky thing because you need a certain resolution to be able to estimate bfactors from your data. Okay. So then we realign all these movie frames, and then we get our new polished or shiny particles. They are better. They have higher signal to noise, so now we go back and reclassify, re-refine. And that actually helped a lot. So for gamma secretase, if we would only do the Schumming scripts, we got 4.9. If we also do this, you get 4.5. And that's nice, because that means that's just the difference between not seeing beta strands and seeing beta strands. Okay, good. To wrap up, a few last points. Going much more into opinion land again. What are the success stories and what are the failures? So success stories, Xiaochen showed this. I think the groups that had invested a lot of time, and Richard and Wazi invested decades in camera developments, and here David invested a lot of time and money with Gatan, and so there's several people who had relatively early access to these cameras due to these investments, and I think those were the earliest success stories. But now that they're commercially available, everybody can buy them, there will be many, many more very soon. So this will soon be as crowded here as all these things were here. So these were then just some of the success stories we heard. Okay. Now, the failures, I don't really know, because you never hear about them. Okay. We have them quite often, though, so there's still many things that don't work. And very often they're related to sample or grid preparation. Okay? So, I don't know, perhaps you don't have many failures, we do. And just some general thoughts, but we've come to move away from negative stain earlier because we can see relatively small things in ice, and then if you do class averages and you see all kind of internal features, that's a good sign. And in negative stain, you would never get those because of the stain size anyway. And we also don't really like cross-linking. For several samples, it kind of made a mess and we couldn't get high resolution class averages either. But that's not to say that you shouldn't try it. This is just some of our experiences, okay? What are the greatest challenges right now and how are we approaching these? Okay, so I think to go significantly beyond 3 angstrom is a great challenge. And I was very excited by Tim's poster on the rotavirus. And I think Holger's talk on CS corrector is very interesting. And it will be very interesting to see what's kind of keeping us at that 3 angstrom barrier, because all those red points are about 3.1, 3.2. You can throw some more asymmetric units at it or a bigger particle and you'll go somewhat beyond, but how can we routinely go to 2.5 angstroms for not so big particles will be very important, especially if we want to interest pharmaceutical industry who want to do all kinds of drug developments. And then the second challenge, I would say, is structural heterogeneity. And I'm very happy and and look forward to the talk of Nico, who will describe some ways of dealing with heterogeneity. And yeah, I think we're all convinced that dealing better with flexible, continuous movements especially is an important thing. Okay. Then, do we need completely new algorithms or just incremental improvements? Well, I think to some extent Steve will discuss a bit of this. So can we make existing algorithms better? If we have a better assessment of raw data quality, we might get better of our existing algorithms, only make reconstruction perhaps with the best particles. I don't know if we will in the end discuss new similarity metrics, but that's up to Steve in a little while. And then, or something completely new, and that's where Joachim comes in, and he will speak about this exciting collaboration he has with Abbas Ulmas, where they do these manifolds. And I think that's something completely new, and it will be very interesting to watch how this develops, because something completely new might be very, very good. Okay, so final few minutes, mistakes to avoid. So overfitting, I think most of us are fine now. Do this or that. If you develop some kind of new algorithm because you think that you can do better, that's very good. We have published this high-resolution noise substitution, which I won't have time to go into, but you can actually measure how much any program overfits the data. And for RelyOn, this was actually a very, very useful tool. So I told Richard, I do gold standard FSCs, I do not overfit. He said, run my program. I ran his program and it did overfit the data. So then I went back into RelyOn and I had several cycles of thinking about this, and it turned out to be masks on maps before Fourier-Shell correlation calculations and so on. I thought I did everything perfect, but I didn't. And it's very difficult to actually get rid of, completely get rid of overfitting. I think it's actually impossible to get completely rid of it. Perhaps Nico will comment on that. Okay? So you can get the program to do these phase randomizations from Richard. Get stuck with the wrong initial model. So I just wanted to put this example here, two very different structures of something that should be relatively similar. D-Day will arrive for every blobby structure when the high-resolution structure comes out, but these things are not good for the field. I think in our hands, this becomes ever less of a problem because we have so good data that you will be able to distinguish a bad initial model from a good one, because if you don't get to see alpha helices, then something is wrong. Okay, so we don't have this much problem anymore. Perhaps we should stop publishing blobs, cryo-EM blobs altogether, but that's a dangerous statement to make because sometimes you can learn a lot about blobs. If you do blobs, I think doing some validation on it would be a very, very good idea, but that will be the topic for tomorrow. Template-based auto-picking, this mistake from the Sodrosky group where model bias is introduced at the stage of template-based picking, which we happen to do quite a lot of in RelyOn as well. There's very useful comments for the students in PNES on this paper that I would really recommend you to read, especially I like Marin's Einstein from Noise pictures. And this can also happen in RelyOn. Be careful. A paper about it has been submitted, and I think it's very important to only use strictly low-pass filtered templates to do your picking. If you didn't put in anything beyond 20 angstrom, nothing beyond 20 angstrom is going to come out. Last thing, I'm almost ready, Joachim. Mistakes to avoid, number four. Monopoly is very bad for any community, I think, because it leads to monocultures, which are vulnerable. And so this is true for microscopes. So I was very happy with Wa's talk yesterday on the JAIL. You get atomic resolution out of a JAIL microscope. I hope we can see one from Zeiss. I don't know how that's going, but this goes a bit towards that, which is not good. Detectors, I'm very happy to hear that people are getting very high resolution results with all of them. I was very excited by Ben's announcement that the DE64 will do counting or so, not too far away in the future. The FEI people are working on counting. The K2 people are making their detector better. They wouldn't do it if the other ones weren't around. If there wasn't Gatam doing a K2, FEI would perhaps sit back and enjoy the moment. So that's important. But the same also holds for software, of course. And I have an obvious conflict of interest here. But there are many packages in the field, and it is to some extent healthy competition between them. And also, one package kind of flows from the other. So XMIP came from Spider, and Relyon again came from XMIP. So we all depend on each other. We rely on users' BSoft code, etc. So I think it's the variety that makes that avoids the mistakes of monoculture. So with that, that's my more or less last slide, is the just three examples that I wanted to include. You can use a FEI microscope or a JIL. You can use a DE Falcon or a K2. And you can use a Relyon or E-Man or Spider or Freeline. And you can all get sidechains, so don't worry. Okay? So image processing will continue to drive the field forward. As has just happened, new hardware will continue to have huge impacts as well. But making good samples already was very crucial, but it will be ever, ever more important. On that note, Chris Tate, Pfizer, and myself are looking for postdocs with experience in mammalian cell expression and membrane protein biochemistry rather than C++, okay? This is a course that we make available for people, for the students in the room who want to know more about the theory. You can just watch some videos. And I thank you for your attention.